We're introducing today a new series called In the Footsteps of the Hasidic Masters. And I'll make most of my disclaimers and qualifying remarks in some of the other sessions. For the purposes of tonight's session, my single qualifying remark or disclaimer is that I'm going to be making some fairly sweeping generalizations during the course of my remarks, and it needs to be understood that that's precisely what they are, that they are sweeping generalizations, that there are some very prominent exceptions to virtually all of these statements. In order for us to understand what transpired, the generation into which the Hasidic masters made their entrance, or more precisely the time that the Baal Shem Tov came upon the scene, I think it's incumbent upon us to first have some sort of a command of what the historical context of the appearance of this this movement called Hasidus, what that context was. Period of time just before the appearance of the Baal Shem Tov was a time of considerable ferment from a great many different perspectives. It was a time of some very widespread, very virulent, and very destructive anti-Semitism, which took a variety of different forms. All of which impacted enormously upon the psyche and the well-being of the Jews of Eastern Europe, actually throughout Russia and Poland and so on. In the mid-17th century, we had the Khmelnytsky massacres, which over a period of time saw hundreds of thousands of deaths. The savagery of the assault on Jews throughout the one of the most populated Jewish centers in the world was incredibly telling, and it was not only the widespread pogroms, the rape, the assault, and taking of whatever modest Jewish wealth there was. It was the humiliation, the complete dehumanization of the Jew, so that the Jew became something less than something human. The forerunner of the Nazi redefinition of the Jew was something that certainly was fleshed out during the 17th century. It's important to note that this was also a period of time in which the economic fortunes of Jews again was in great disrepair. Jews were locked out of most of the crafts and professions. Amongst the few things that they could do were things that had to do with the exchange of money or the collection of taxes, which of course only further increased the profile of the Jews as a people that were to be despised and hated. Whether it was in many instances the fact that they weren't allowed to own property or farms or to farmland or what have you, the economic plight of the Jew at the time was very grave. And the disenfranchisement of the Jew from every area of life, even those people at the time who sought to assimilate, imparted to the world Jewish community a sense of humiliation which was probably unparalleled for many centuries. It's also important to note that in the wake of all of these disasters, and we also, I suppose, need to add to that something which was applicable to the non-Jewish world as well as to the Jewish world, which was the fact that there was still no handle on diseases. And so the plagues, infant mortality, the loss of women in childbirth were all things which contributed towards the distressed emotional state of the Jew during this period of time. In the wake of all of these natural, political, and historical disasters, there came what one might call a predictable phenomenon, which were messianic movements. The most prominent of which was a fellow by the name of Shabtai Tzvi, Yimach Shemai, Zichrei. Shabtai Tzvi was, in his time, was a young man who had achieved great notoriety with both from the standpoint of his brilliance in Talmudic scholarship and especially so in his Kabbalistic genius. Apparently a very charismatic kind of person who developed a following about himself with all kinds of, at first, subtle promises of redemption. Subsequently, he openly proclaimed himself to be the long-awaited Mashiach, and because of his charisma and because of his knowledge of the Kabbalah, drew a following of tens and perhaps hundreds of thousands of Jews throughout the civilized world. That Shabtai Tzvi was a very twisted person, eventually became was revealed by a variety of some pretty sordid details which began to come out about his conduct and and the conduct of members of his immediate court. There really were some fairly nasty things which occurred, which probably should not be discussed in public. Shabtai Tzvi was eventually summoned. He was arrested and was summoned to the Sultan, where he was given an ultimatum of either converting to the Muslim faith or that he would have to part company with his head. He discovered that he was very attached to his head, and he was less so attached to his faith, and he converted to the Mohammedan faith, a fact which dashed the hopes and the dreams of all of these followers many tens of thousands of whom had sold their homes and their belongings in anticipation of the fact that he was going to lead them to Eretz Yisrael. So on top of all of this insult and injury which the Jews had suffered sociologically and economically during this period of time, and all of this oppression and persecution and pogroms, they were also subject to their own internal humiliation, which was the disappointment of this redemption by this false Mashiach. Subsequently, there were a smattering of other such Kabbalistic champions, amongst whom was a group called the Frankisten. Their leader was a fellow whose last name was, not first name, whose last name was Frank. And the damage that they caused was very considerable, and left Klal Yisrael disillusioned, not only in the hope of redemption, but in its own leadership. There was a crisis of trust here. Who were they going to trust? Their leaders had disappointed them. On top of all of this, there was something which I don't have a good name for, but I will call it an internal disenfranchisement, an internal loss of self-worth, esteem, and identity. We have always been, from time immemorial, we've been a nation dedicated to Torah scholarship. We always knew Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, that the study of Torah was the supreme value in Jewish life. Through the ages, in support and in pursuit of that goal, there emerged a Torah elite, and the nature of that kind of focus became extremely narrow, to the point where it became a virtually exclusive criterion of importance, significance, and value in Jewish communal life. We have to remember that Jews were scattered all over the map, that there were hordes of Jews who lived in little hamlets and towns and villages without access to any great centers of learning, that the poverty forced most families to abort their children's education at early ages so that they could go out and help earn money to support what were even then large families, and just to try to keep up with the poverty, to apprentice children at early ages so that they might learn some kind of a skill which might enable them to support themselves later on. And what came of that was that there was an inordinately great number of people, perhaps a disproportionately great number of people, who, unlike other generations where there was either greater affluence or there was greater access to the centers of learning, there was a great mass of people whose education was arrested at an early age, whose ability to be able to respect themselves and in any great measure for their Torah scholarship was severely constricted, and who found themselves to some extent really devalued within their own frame of reference, let alone the fact that they had no value within the non-Jewish context, but they really had kind of lost standing within our own system of values. To have lost respect or to have lost significance in the sight of the non-Jewish world was one insult, but to have lost value within our own system and our own context was more than just adding insult to injury. It was a loss of the very foundation, the very footing that allowed people to carry themselves with any measure of self-esteem. In addition, from many of the writings of the time, we find that it was very popular that there would be these magidim, that there would be these rabbis who would travel from city to city, community to community, and town to town, and would stay for a short period of time, usually a week or two, spending a Shabbos in a community, upbraiding and chastising and admonishing the community for its wrongdoing. So here we have yet another measure of salt poured into the wounds. Not only were they already subject to their own condemnation, but they would find themselves rebuked constantly for the fact that they were that they weren't performing, that they weren't measuring up. And that excoriation was extremely devastating in a variety of different ways, which subsequently was a target for one of the campaigns of the Hasidic movement. So we have, if we look over the broad panorama of Jewish life at the time, we find the Jew despised by the non-Jewish world, devalued by his own Jewish world, held in self-contempt for values which he himself, which each person themselves espoused, and then further admonished repeatedly by periodic scolding that would come from yet another level of leadership in Jewish life. From the standpoint of what our sages tell us about Yaakov Avinu when he returned from his long stay with Lavan, where he had lived under conditions which were very inimical to everything that he held sacred, everything that was precious to him. So we are told, Vayova Yankiv Shalem Yashchem, Yankiv came Shalem. He came whole, he came complete to the city of Shechem. Our sages tell us, as Rashi quotes, that Yaakov arrived Shalem Begufa, Shalem Bememaina, Shalem Beteirose, that he was whole, that Yaakov escaped unscathed from the clutches of all of his enemies, and that he was shalem, he was perfect, he was complete, and he was whole in body, he was whole in his earthly belongings, in his possessions, and that he was whole and complete in his Torah, that his Torah also was not compromised. From this standpoint, if shlemus, if being whole, is dependent upon these three dimensions, we can see how distant from Shlemus was the fate of 17th century Jewry. They were decimated in body by constant and very savage attacks on their person and on their physical belongings, their material belongings. They were highly taxed and taken advantage of and despoiled in their money and in their physical belongings, and even from the standpoint of their Torah, they were deficient, legitimately. That is, that they were in fact in large measure deficient, but they held themselves and were held in contempt, such that there was no shlemus. And in an environment in which there was no shlemus, we can see that the mood of 17th century Jewry was extremely grim. It's also important for us to take a look at what was taking place at the level of those people who were not so deprived or who were not so humiliated, namely the learned class. The spiritual elite of Klal Yisrael. The spiritual elite at Klal Yisrael at the time had reserved for itself, or had come to reserve for itself, a position of a certain aristocracy, which clearly left the simple folk lagging in the far distance. The leaders, in large measure the rabbis of the community, had come to narrow the legitimate responsibilities of Jewish leadership such that it was no longer what it had once been. The Ramban tells us in Parshas Vayisro, rather well-known Ramban, that when Yisro found his son-in-law Moshe Rabbeinu, the first leader of the Jewish people, he found him preoccupied from the early morning to late at night with the affairs of Klal Yisrael, that he criticized him, and he told him that this was no way to run a railroad. To which Moshe Rabbeinu responded as follows. He said to him, one thing he said to him is, the nation comes to seek God. Further, he says to him, when they have litigation, or when there is some contention between them, they come to me so that I may judge between a person and their friend. And what's more, I teach them the laws of Hashem. And the Ramban says that there are three functions here. That the first function of a leader is that the function of a Jewish leader is to deal with the concerns of the nation, such as may relate to praying for their sick, advising them where they might best seek things that they had lost. This was common in those days. People would go and would ask a prophet, I've misplaced my the keys to my car. Because they didn't have keys to their cars in those days. Whatever was the equivalent in those days that people would have lost, they would come to the prophet and to the leader for matters which were very mundane and very, very pedestrian, and it was the function of the leader to be concerned with those things. And the fact that someone cared about the sick, that it was understood that while there is no intermediary and there is no intercession, which is necessary for an individual to approach God, every person approaches God in their own right, but nonetheless, there was a recognition that there are people of greater standing, of people whose saintliness, whose piety, whose greatness in every area of life qualifies them to be more privy to the Almighty's attention, so to speak. So people would come and ask of the leader to intercede on their behalf with the Almighty. That was one function. Second function was that of a judge. And when there's litigation or contention, that the leader would act as a judge. And the third one was that of a teacher. It's fair to say that the latter two remained legitimate functions of the rabbis of most of the communities of Israel throughout the ages. But that the first function came into some disrepair, that it was increasingly less and less seen as the function of the rabbi of a community to be someone whose saintliness and piety qualified them to address the nation's pedestrian concerns. They might indeed be involved in differences and disputes between people. They might indeed teach Hashem's halacha or hashkafa, but the involvement in the smaller affairs of Klal Yisrael was seen as something that was not the legitimate scope of the rabbinate. And it's important for us to know yet one other very conspicuous and I believe a very central feature of Jewish leadership. And again, by the way, I remind you about the fact that this is not a sweeping condemnation. There were some very illustrious exceptions to this rule. The Medrash describes to us in a variety of different ways the reasons that Moshe Rabbeinu and subsequently David HaMelech were chosen to be kings of Israel. And they each involved a certain kind of compassion and attention which they gave to the animals under their care when they were humble shepherds. In the case of Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was caring for the flocks of his father-in-law Yisrael, one of the little lambs ran away from the flock, and Moshe Rabbeinu went after this lamb and ultimately found this, I don't know if it was a he or she, but found this little lamb drinking from a brook. And Moshe Rabbeinu was very overcome with remorse that he wasn't sensitive to the thirst of his flock, and he after this little sheep had drunk its fill, he subsequently carried the sheep back to the flock on his shoulders. And the Almighty saw this entire scene and saw the compassion with which Moshe Rabbeinu dealt with this single little lamb, and this was, the Midrash tells us, one of the prime recommendations that Moshe Rabbeinu was fit to be a leader of Klal Yisrael. This kind of shepherd mentality, this kind of parental love and caring is something which was very evident throughout Moshe Rabbeinu's leadership of Klal Yisrael, that he constantly went to the mat for them. He was championing their cause. He was their advocate. Even when they were guilty of all kinds of wrongdoing, even when they complained bitterly against him, nonetheless, Moshe Rabbeinu, through thick and thin, remained a caretaker of Klal Yisrael. And in this kind of concern on the part of a leader, this parental, this very warm, loving concern was something which had begun to absent itself from the profile of Jewish leadership. Not that they were without warmth or concern, but the level of that kind of involvement with the plight of the entire community was something that had begun to be attenuated. On a personal level, it seemed that in every stratum of Jewish life, including the highest such strata, he can't even talk with his hands these days. That there was a certain diminution in the fervor and in the excitement, perhaps more significant in the respect for that fervor or excitement, in the all-encompassing attention which was being addressed to the world of Jewish scholarship. the world of the Jewish mind began to eclipse the world of the Jewish heart. And as such, the Avodas HaTfilah, the service of the heart, service of prayer, all of the rich emotion which was associated with the awe of the Almighty and the love of the Almighty, as well as the awe and the love for every Jewish neshama, was in less evidence. To some extent, it was almost as though the body of Klal Yisrael had lost some of its robust qualities, some of its richest qualities. Along with that, not only was it the pillar of Aveda, which no longer seemed to carry the great significance that it once did, but similarly, Gemilus Chasadim, the simple acts of loving kindness, which went between people, which joined people to one another, in deference to the rule of Ahavta L'Reacha Kamecha, was again less and less significant. Almost exclusive supremacy of Torah scholarship occupied people's attentions. It seemed as though everything else was no longer important. And we must remember that while the Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam certainly imparts and confers that supremacy upon the study of Torah, but it does not strip the Avodas HaTfilah or the service of the heart, nor does it vitiate the significance of Gemilus Chasadim as both being of great value and precious in the sight of the Almighty. What's more, history has different times, in much the same way that as a person from between birth and death goes through different seasons and different times, and there's a period of infancy and childhood and early adolescence and the teenage years and the early adulthood and the time of strength and all of the different periods which are identified by our sages as a person grows and goes through all of the different phases of life. That's equally true in the phases of and in the seasoning of or the maturation of a nation. And there are different needs for different times. And we find that right around the advent of the Hasidic movement, that there was an explosion of both knowledge and opportunity to access the knowledge of the Kabbalah, beginning with the appearance of the Ari HaKadosh, whose revolution in our exposure to the Chachmas HaSayyid, to this heretofore rather closely held Kabbalistic knowledge, along with the discovery of the ancient work of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in the Sefer HaZayar, these writings and this wisdom began to make great inroads on the world of Jewish scholarship. The Sefer HaZayar was discovered in the time of the Ramban, and a short time later was appearance of the Ari HaKadosh, and as we will soon see, this was a period in the development of Klal Yisrael where the need for a mystical experience became extremely important. So it's against this backdrop that we find the appearance of the first Hasidic master, the Baal Shem HaKadosh. Now, before we talk about him specifically, we're going to talk about some of the things that that the Baal Shem Tov brought to the attention of Klal Yisrael. But I think it's very important for us to deal with some misconceptions. The appearance of Hasidus is in certain precincts of popular literature and interpretation is considered a reformation. On occasion is used as a precedent for other kinds of reformation. It's important for us to understand the difference between a reformation and a restoration. A reformation implies that there is a kind of a rehabilitation of, a redoing of, a rejection of that which was formerly there, and this is an introduction of things which are new and different. It's a change of course in the stream. It implies new definitions. The Baal Shem HaKadosh, as I will demonstrate in some of our future sessions, did not in any seminal or fundamental way introduce something new. Virtually, without exception, everything that the Baal Shem HaKadosh taught is found in the classical sources of Klal Yisrael. These different components of Jewish life suffered. Many of them became either lost by virtue of some peculiar quirk of communal atrophy, or were not accorded any legitimate attention. The bottom line is that the Baal Shem Tov once again brought them to public attention and integrated them into the ongoing expression, the living expression of Teres Yisrael. I think that it's also critical that we appreciate yet one other very fundamental fact. The Baal Shem Tov did not appear to make this restoration because it was something that he perceived to be a direly needed correction of course. Even had that been the case, there would likely have been great justification, in as much as the Baal Shem Tov would have done so on the basis of our classic and traditional attitudes and practices. However, the Baal Shem Tov acted, as became clear subsequently when the circumstances of his appearance became better known, that he acted under what we must practically deal with as a heavenly declaration. That is, that he was instructed by forces beyond the ordinary, that he must emerge from his self-imposed obscurity to introduce the restorative adjustments which he came to make in Klal Yisrael. The reason that this is so critical is because it's very inviting for people from time to time throughout Jewish history to see themselves as one or another form of Messiah, deliverer, redeemer, champion, advocate, for us to be tempted to make changes founded on our perceptions of the fact that that we must do something to save Klal Yisrael. And we must be extremely wary of those temptations, because almost without exception, that's precisely what they are. They're temptations. They're opportunities for ego trips, for self-aggrandizement, for people to claim a chunk of adoration, adulation, and public acclaim for themselves. The Baal Shem Tov did not act under any of these kinds of motivations. Baal Shem Tov was forced out of obscurity by a series of events which were directed from above, precisely to provide a counterbalance to what was going on in Jewish life, and really ultimately to invest Klal Yisrael with the ability to survive all of the challenges to its integrity onto our own time, as will eventually become clear that the fact that after the Holocaust of Europe that there was a remnant that was able to rebuild and to reinvest Klal Yisrael with a newfound intensity, a newfound vitality. All of that really is traceable to the influence of the Baal Shem Tov and the successors to Hasidic leadership. So number one, the Baal Shem Tov was not a reformer. He did not teach anything new. Essentially, he came to bring to attention some of the classic tenets, attitudes, and practices of Klal Yisrael. If anything, the contribution of the Baal Shem Tov can be seen in the very unique way in which he wove the fabric of all of these classic attitudes and practices so that they would lend themselves to be embraced by 18th century Judaism throughout the many lands in which Hasidus became widely embraced. He understood what priority to give them. He understood how they were to fit in with the entirety of Jewish life, and was able to prescribe for this ailing Jewish public polity a prescription that would be an elixir of life. I think some of us who, just some of us, parenthetically, who kind of feel the what growing older does to us, such things as making it a little bit more difficult to read letters that are getting smaller, or to hear sounds which we were formerly able to do, and we find ourselves using glasses and sometimes hearing aids and some vitamins or some medications or whatnot to keep us in a state of good health and enable us to interact well. I think we need to recognize that Klal Yisrael, to some extent, was marching into the last phase of Jewish history. That we were in this time, which our sages had deemed ikvas of the Mashiach. This was kind of the heels of Jewish history. We had gone through some of the strongest, some of the headiest, some of the most brilliant periods of Jewish history, times of great accomplishment and times of great achievement. And we were now at a point where the once very strong sounds of the declarations of Har Sinai were such that they were no longer as sharp, that they no longer resonated with the same kind of force which they did in the past. And we needed the glasses to help us see clear. We needed the vitamins and the various exercises to keep us in as a nation, such that we would be firmly in contact with the proclamations of Har Sinai, which was the heartbeat of Judaism. It was this kind of a contribution which the Baal Shem Tov brought to some extent to the golden years, the older age of Klal Yisrael, as we moved to the time of Israel's ultimate redemption. We needed that heaven, in its compassion for the fate, the spiritual fate of Klal Yisrael, should recognize that Klal Yisrael needs an infusion of energy, an infusion of that kind of assistance which will enable us to deal with the challenges to faith that these last 500 years of this sixth millennium of creation would demand. The Rishonah comments on one of the Hashainas. It says, Sholei Shois Hashaina. We recite this on the last day of Sukkot. 3 hours. Hashaina, help us please. Hashaina. The Rishonah comments that the last 3 hours before Mashiach comes, that it will be so difficult to maintain our faith that we will be hanging on literally by our fingernails in order to be able to continue to sustain our faith in everything that was formerly understood to be central to Jewish thought. And we call on the Almighty, Sholei Shois, for those last 3 hours. We appeal to the Almighty to help us that we should not lose our hold on our faith for those last critical moments. And what we were dealing with in effect in this last period of time, the last number of centuries, to some extent was the fact that there were some very, very strong challenges to Jewish existence, and Almighty in His compassion sent the Baal Shem HaKadosh and His successors to help us deal with the kinds of challenges that we were going to face. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what some of those new challenges, what we spoke about, what some of the old challenges were, which were the complete humiliation, degradation, the disenfranchisement of the Jew from every quarter and every precinct of life. But there were to be new challenges which we were going to be confronting from the middle of the, really from the 18th century on. We must remember that with Galileo, who appeared sort of at the end of the Renaissance, that there was a birth of for all practical intents and purposes, of the scientific community, the scientific methodology, the scientific and empirical world. We found during the 18th century there was the Industrial Revolution, which began roughly midway into the 18th century, in the 1750s and onward, the French Revolution, its freedoms, and so on. The sum total of all of these new challenges was such that the world in general, but Jews in particular, were confronted by something that was to undermine some of the strongest aspects of and facets of faith. For one, the sciences, as even they were in their nascent state, but there was a certain growing arrogance of the role of reason, the supremacy of the human mind, its legitimate right to pronounce the verdict of truth or legitimacy upon everything which came its way. And at the beginning of empiricism, the veneration of the senses, the pursuit of pleasure. What's more, as the Industrial Revolution was to grant greater and greater technological control of the world, it also implied the fact that the human being was to have not only control of his physical world, but also was entitled to control of his spiritual world. There is a rule which reads that if the forces of saintliness, of sanctity grow, that we can anticipate that there's going to be a commensurate growth in the strength of the forces of immorality and evil, or conversely, that if there is to be an appearance of a greater volume, a greater strength of the world of evil and immorality, that we can anticipate that the Almighty will not leave us without a commensurate force to stand up against the world which was to appear the world of evil, that there would be something to provide a counterpoint to that. In a world which was on the threshold of this scientific revolution, and which placed the mind of man on a pedestal, it was requisite that we appreciated the necessity, or that we were given access to something which would allow us to hold on to a world which was not subject to the laboratory or to the empirical approach. We would not have fared terribly well, and in fact lost myriads of people to this newly enlightened world with its growing volume of theory and research and technological progress. If we were left somehow without the wherewithal to attach equal relevance and equal believability in our supernatural and our religious world. It must be remembered that one of the concomitant phenomena of the Baal Shem Tov and the Hasidic masters which followed in his wake were the fact that these people were of such stature that their access to forces which were clearly not natural forces was able to open up a horizon of such rich mystical experience, an experience which opened itself in some very explicit ways, ways in which Klal Yisrael saw in a certain way reminiscent of the times in which the Almighty's wonders, in which his miracles were apparent throughout Jewish experience. These Hasidic masters accessed a world for Klal Yisrael in which they were able to touch something that was, if anything, at least as strong and then some as all of the glorious and exalted promises which the world was to open before the curious Jewish minds. And here we were with a faith experience which said to us, we have nothing to cringe about, nothing to retreat from, nothing to be ashamed of, that our world was more than equal to the challenges of this world that was in great transition and great ferment, which was opening up on an accelerated basis, was opening up all kinds of new frontiers in human knowledge. So yet another and an extremely significant contribution that Hasidus brought, although it was not part of its formal presentation. Hasidus brought to a world that was to burgeon with science and discovery. It brought a world of religious experience, which was rich, which was deep, which was gratifying, which gave people the knowledge that there was a higher order authority over this universe, to which even the world of science needed to pay homage. The centerpiece of the Hasidic movement, and we'll discover all of the blossoms that this were inherent in the centerpiece. But the centerpiece of the Hasidic movement was the Rebbe. The Rebbe who was the shepherd, the Rebbe who was the Moshe Rabbeinu, the one who carried the parental concern, the one who was preoccupied even with the simple day-to-day commonplace interests of their communities and their following, who would be their champion before the Almighty, where people would come to pour their hearts out in the knowledge that here was someone whose saintliness brought them closer to the Almighty, someone who would understand their physical needs, their spiritual needs. And again, to fulfill a role in Jewish life which had lost some of its vitality. Our sages tell us in a variety of different ways of the need for each person to have such a particular person. Aseh lecha rav, we are told a number of times in Pirkei Avos and elsewhere in Shas, that a person needs to have a rav. And even in Pirkei Avos itself, there are different reasons. In one case, it appears in the context of Kenei Lechachava. Each person should have a rav, and they should have a bosom friend. They should have a very close confidant, friend, a companion, a comrade. In another instance, it appears in the context of Vehistalik Menasafik. If you will have a rav, an authority, then it will free you of doubt. There are formal concerns that we have, and we need to have someone who can direct us in our formal concerns. But there's another need, a need which fits in with the context of someone having a good friend, and that's Aseh Lecha Rav, to have a rav who can serve as someone who is going to be this individual who worries about you, who's going to storm the gates of heaven on your behalf. In the Kabbalistic writings, there is an understanding that in every age, in every era, and in fact in every community, that there is a shiur kema, that there is a configuration, that the community itself, the entity of Klal Yisrael, represents figuratively, it represents a body. And there are all kinds of limbs and organs in the body, and there's a heart that pumps blood and nutrition to all of the cells of the body, however remote those cells may be in the body. That there are lungs that breathe and send oxygen to every cell of the body, and that there are eyes that see and enable the body to navigate, and that there is a head that thinks, that reasons, that counsels, that guides. The fact that if there were to be a body that were to have all of its necessary components, but devoid of a head, that this body would not only be devoid of life, but even assuming that there was somehow, that there was a nervous system that was intact and functional, but that there could be no coherence or cohesiveness, that there would be no rhyme or reason, that there would be no direction, and ultimately that there could be no sense of fulfillment without the direction that the head would impart, is something which was at the very center of Hasidic thought. The Rebbe, the Rav, was the head. In much the same sense that if we wanted to figure out what to do when we felt that things were not right, and that we understood that was the time in which we should invoke our critical faculties, that we should think, and we should reason, and we should analyze, and we should act in a very deliberate way. In much that same way, Klal Yisrael must recognize that if we're to be certain that we're on course and that we're not marching to an unhealthy rhythm, or that we are not being misled, or that what is in reality is not a state of good health, is interpreted as a state of good health. And for all of these reasons, we need this central figure to whom we can place our lives, our misgivings, our problems, our conflicts, our questions of direction in life. The Rebbe was the Reish, the head par excellence. It was the Rebbe who understood the neshama of each one of his followers. A chassid could approach his Rebbe knowing that he could freely disclose his blemishes, his warts, his shortcomings, his iniquity, his trials and tribulations, with the understanding that the Rebbe saw his neshama in its noblest and most exalted form, and that the Rebbe would expose this person to this vision of personal greatness that inhered in each person. The Rebbe was the individual who set the tone, who created the harmony of the entire community of people, who acted at once as its beacon, its counsel, its parent, its good friend, its intercessor between themselves and the Almighty whenever their needs were such that it left them in need or in pain. It was to this very critical juncture in history that the Baal Shem Tov came. He came to a time in which Jews as a whole, were caught between two worlds, a world of complete destruction and humiliation and dehumanization on the one hand, where there was no hope and no place and no value and no self-respect, and on the other hand, a challenge to faith, which was waiting for them on the other side of history, such that with the world of science, this world which was going to impart a new arrogance to the human mind, the capacity to be able to withstand these challenges to faith would have found Klal Yisrael in a very, very weakened state from every which standpoint. It was to this world that the Baal Shem Tov appeared and offered a restoration of values which were part of our tradition from the earliest times of Torah and in antiquity, and breathed new life into these tissues. And as he did so, and brought the centrality of the Rebbe to the fortunes of Klal Yisrael, the well-being and the direction, the fortunes of Klal Yisrael were secured between that last virtually the last half century, the last half millennium of history until the time of Mashiach Tzidkenu. There's no question in the minds of any critical thinker that the contribution of the Baal Shem Tov is exclusively responsible for the fact that the Klal Yisrael has survived until this day. Next time we convene, we will be speaking specifically about what these restorative measures were, and about the very peculiar gifts and personality of the Baal Shem Tov.